Professor Jorah Barnett-Hahn from the University of Toronto. He's here because our math department has suddenly decided not to be so insular and to actually invite people who do subjects outside of the very narrowly defined constructs that we've made over the last 50 years. And so we welcome him. Now, the question is, what is going on right now? It's an undergraduate talk on commutators. I'm very much looking forward to it, and I'll simply say that Dr. Barnett-Hahn has held the Benjamin Pierce instructorship at Harvard University, which is one of the most prestigious named postdoctoral fellowships in North America. After that, he went to Tel Aviv University, or Hebrew University in Israel, and then eventually made his way back to what I would like to consider part of America, Toronto. However, I'm told that it's ruled by rational social democrats, so at any rate, it's not part of America.
Okay.
All right, fair enough. And without further ado, Dr. Barnett-Hahn.
So, thank you. I will be talking about commutators, and I will tell you about several problems that sort of in which the word commutator occurs. And one of the problems I care about more than the rest, but I'll start with the rest. Now my talk will follow a handout, and I hope you all have copies. Is there anybody who does not have a copy of the handout? So please pick up one. Okay? Anyway, here it is on the screen, but it's just a summary of the slides that are to follow. And in fact, here is the first slide that is to follow, and it is the definition. So if you have, sorry, so I do need a tiny bit of prerequisites. I hope you all know what a group is. Does it make sense? Is it right? So a group is where you can multiply things and where things have inverses, but the multiplication is not necessarily commutative. So a commutator, so the commutator of two elements, x and y, in a group G, is it denoted x bracket y, and it's x times y times the inverse of x times the inverse of y. So you go x, you go y, you go x backwards, you go y backwards. If x and y were commuting, like the real numbers, then you'd swap the order of the middle two terms, and then the x will cancel the x backwards, and the y would cancel the y backwards, and the whole thing will be 1, okay? But in a group, sometimes that's not 1, okay? Anyway, examples. So consider the group S3 of permutation. So you all know this group? I did suggest what the prerequisites are, and make hopefully this was included, tiny bit of group theory. I don't remember, but anyway. So in the group S3, the commutator of the cycle 1-2 with the cycle 2-3, so maybe I will do it in writing. So the cycle, how do I turn on the light? Maybe I should learn how to do it. Okay, so the cycle 1-2 is just the permutation which maps 1 to 2 and 2 to 1, right? That's the cycle 1, 2. And the cycle 2, 3 is the permutation which maps 2 to 3 and 3 to 2. So what's the composition of 1, 2 followed by 2-3 followed by 1-2 inverse followed by 2-3 inverse. What does it come out to be? Let's calculate. Okay, so where will 1 go? So my convention is that I compose from left to right. Okay, so 1 goes to 2 via the first cycle, then to 3 via the second cycle. It stays at 3 because this one doesn't even touch 3, right? And then 3 goes to 2 via the inverse of this cycle. The inverse of 2, 3 is 2, 3 itself, right? If the only thing you do is to flip 2 and 3, the inverse is to do the same. So 1 went to 3 at the end, right? To 2, sorry. So 1 went to 2, then to 3, and then 3 went to 2, so 1 went to 2. Okay? Where does 2 go? So 2 goes to 1. 1 gets ignored by this, so it stays at 1. Then it goes to 2, and then it goes to 3, so 2 goes to 3. Right? And where does 3 go? Well, it has only one place left, but let's verify that we got it right. So 3 it's ignored by this, then it goes to 2, then it goes to 1, and then it stays in place, so 3 went to 1. And if you want, I could write this as the cycle, so this is the same as writing the cycle 1, 2, 3. So 1 goes to 2, 2 goes to 3, 3 goes to 1. Okay? So this is all happening in S3. Now let's look in S4, because I still want examples, right? So in S4, you could compute, maybe I will not do it and I will skip straight to S5, but in S4, you can compute that the composition of the cycle IJK with the cycle, the commutator of the cycle IJK with the cycle JKL, so here I mean I, J, and K, and J, K, and L are any three indices. So in fact, this is not just in S4, it's in S greater than or equal to 4. In any permutation group, in any group of permutations in which you can find at least four indices, you can compute that the commutator of I, J, K with J, K, L is actually, let's start, okay? So let's figure out where does I go, okay? So I goes to J, then via this one it goes to K, then via the inverse of this one it goes to J. I'm going backwards, so it goes to J, and then via this, the inverse of this one, J goes to L. So I goes to L. And I could continue with this computation and hopefully get the same result as in the handout, which is L goes to I, so this cycle closes, and I have a new cycle starting, and J goes to K, and K goes to J. Is this okay? Okay. And then, in any permutation group greater than 5, I claim that the commutator of I, J, K with K, L, M, so this is my last example, is equal to, actually let's figure it out, okay? So, I goes to J, J stays in place, and then I do this one backwards, so J goes to I, and then I stays in place, so I goes to itself, I don't need to say anything about it. Okay, J goes to K, K goes to L, via the backwards of this, L stays in place. Via the backwards of this, L goes to K. So J went to K. K goes to I. I stays in place. Now via the inverse of this, I goes to K. And then via the inverse of this, K goes to M. So I get JKM. And you can check that L stays in place. So this is the result. I hope it's consistent with what I got. Absolutely dull, isn't it? Completely boring. It has no interest whatsoever. Hopefully, the interest will come in a minute. Maybe still at the level of examples, let me point out that this result in S greater than or equal to 5 is kind of strange, because it says that a cycle of 3 is the commutator of 2 cycles of 3. Of length 3, right? And I can iterate this and get something funny. So the cycle of the commutator of so the cycle 1, 2, 3, well, you see, I can substitute J is equal to 1, K is equal to 2, M is equal to 3, and then just take I and L to be other things, and then I'll find that 123 is the commutator of 412 with 253. But you see, 412 is again three things. I could set J is equal to 4, K is equal to 1, M is equal to 2, and I could write 412 as the commutator of 341 and 152. And likewise, I could write 253 as the commutator of 125 and 543. Okay? So I could write a single cycle as a commutator of two commutators, but I could go on and I could write it as the commutator of two commutators of two commutators. And I could go on, and if I try to say it, my language will break, I'll get confused. But I think you see the point. 123 can be written as a funny iterated commutator you need 2 to the n cycles, but at the end you'll be writing 123 as a commutator of commutators of commutators of commutators. Who cares? I don't know. Okay? Maybe I do know, but it will take me a minute to show. But anyway, a few examples of things where commutators are useful. So the first belongs to the building across the bridge, right? The computer science building. So in cryptography, people sometimes care about sending messages. So, and these people are always called Alice and Bob in computer science, because A and B. So, are you Alice?
Sure.
Thank you. Alice wants to send, that's why I asked. So Alice wants to send a message to Bob, who is seated over there. Okay, and the problem is that she she doesn't trust the person who is going to deliver the message, meaning me. Okay, so she wants to transfer the message to Bob in such a way that I cannot open it on the way, right? Now, if Bob and Alice had met before, have you met before? Let's pretend you didn't. So, if Bob and Alice had met before, then they decide on some code, right? Maybe, she would write in Pig Latin and then I could not read it, okay? Or in some funny Greek, whatever. And then I would not be able to read it. But if they've never met before, what do they do? How do they transfer the message so that I will not be able to read it? I mean, she can't send him the code because, I'll be reading what she's sending. I'll be reading the code, she can't send him the cipher because she can't send him the key because I'll be reading the key. So what do we do? It must be impossible.
Yeah.
It seems impossible, but of course it is possible. So the clever way to do it, and I wish I had two paper clips, just to indicate how it's done. So Alice has one paperclip. Everybody has a paperclip. Bob has another paperclip. So what we do is Alice looks the message. Thank you very much. So, okay, I did it with a paperclip, but I really meant an unbreakable lock. Okay? Some lock which is made of cryptanium. Okay? Something that I cannot break, no way. Okay? But she locks the message. Now it's locked. Now, even though I'm not reliable and I'm carrying it to Bob, I cannot open it and read it because it's locked. Now, Bob puts his own kryptonite lock somewhere else on the message, and I carry the message back to Alice. Alice removes her lock, but it's still locked. Now it's locked with Bob's lock. Okay, so I still cannot read it. I carry it to Bob. Bob removes his lock and can read the message. Read it at any point along the way, except I wrote it, so it doesn't work, but okay, well, fine.
How does she know that it was Bob's lock?
What?
How does she know it was Bob's lock?
Not yours.
Yes, you're right. There are further issues with cryptography, but you know, we've solved the basic problem. You know, there will be remaining problems to solve afterwards. Okay, how to authenticate who wrote the message? That would be a different problem. Okay, but what happened here? What had happened here was we locked with lock A, Alice's. What's your real name?
Kate.
Kate. Anyway, sorry. We locked with lock A, then with B, then with the inverse of A, we unlocked A, and then we unlocked B. So what we did was we precisely applied a commutator. And in fact, the property that needed to hold, and it's not an obvious property, is that the two locks commute. So the commutator must be the identity. So for physical locks that are placed on a box at different places, it's clear that they commute. If you lock one, lock the other, unlock one, unlock the other, it's clear that the message comes back to itself. But had this been a cryptographical lock, meaning she would have encrypted the message using some strange cryptographical gadget, okay? And then Bob would encrypt it using a different one, then the issue about the commutativity of the locks of the encoding schemes would matter. So in fact, that's the first example of a use of a commutator. But this is sort of a silly use. We actually want, you know, we see a commutator when we implement this protocol, and we want to make sure that this commutator is trivial. Okay? So let's move on. Is it any questions, any comments? Can I move on to the next example? Okay, so the next example, well, that's a silly problem, but still. Can you hang a picture on a string on the wall using n nails? Let's start with n is equal to 1, then 2, then maybe 3, so that if you remove any one of them, the picture will fall. This is, by the way, a picture of Évariste Galois, who is the real star of, or in some sense, the real star of this talk. But can we do it? So here it is, hanging on the wall. In fact, here it is, hanging on the wall. And it has the, I'm sorry for the people seated over there. You know, maybe, yeah, but I don't think I can hang it elsewhere. You know what, let's pretend that Kate's fingers, Kate, can you volunteer? Is this okay? I just chose you at almost at random. The nails. So does it have the property that if she removes any one of them, the picture will fall?
Please don't remove it.
So let's see, remove this, pull this one out. Oops, the picture didn't fall. It fell down a bit, but I really wanted to drop all the way down. So is there, for n equals 1, can you remove your this nail, this one thing? Oh, the picture did fall. So solving the problem for n equals 1 is easy, right? But can you solve it for n equals 2? Can you hang a picture on the wall using two nails in such a way that if you remove any one of them, the picture will drop down? Do you know how to do it, Kate? Okay,
no.
I'll ask you to come again in a minute, but let me tell you how to do it. And I want to tell you how to do it because, well, basically because it's a 60-minute talk, so. Okay, anyway, here's how you do it. So let's let's use some notation, okay? So here are my two nails. Let's call them nail X and nail Y, okay? And let's declare that starting from here, going over nail X from left to right is what I will call X, and going over nail X from right to left is what I will call X inverse. Okay? And likewise, this will be going, this will be Y, and this will be Y inverse. Okay? Does it make sense? Well, it does, because you see, if I take a string and I let it go over X, and then go over X inverse, the picture will fold. Right? If I have a string which hangs the picture in this manner, so my finger is now X, right? If I remove, in fact, don't, if I don't even remove nail X, I mean, even if nail X stays, right? This is a stupid way of hanging a picture. Okay? So you can guess how I want to hang the picture. I want to hang the picture using the commutator of X and Y. The commutator of X and Y is X, Y, X inverse, Y inverse. And let's see what it means in terms of pictures, in terms of hanging. So I go on over X, then in principle I go back down, right? But, well, going back down and then up, it doesn't make sense. I could tighten the string, okay? So I'll just go over Y, then over X inverse, and then over Y inverse, and then back. If you hang this a picture this way, no matter which nail you remove, the picture will fall. Let's see. If I remove this nail, then basically this end can, you can kind of pull it, you can see it, right? And then you can, I'll leave you to watch it. So thank you very much, Kate, you've understood it right. You are the nail, so I hang X, Y, then X inverse, and then Y inverse, sorry, it's a bit tight. And now, remove, you choose which one to remove, sorry, no! That's fine. Anyway, it worked. Okay? Now, this is the solution for two. How would you do it for three? Oh, maybe before, no, it's fine, it's fine. I think the point is clear, right? Is it? By the way, why did it work, group theoretically? Group theoretically, it worked because, or not quite group theoretically, because I didn't quite define a group, I didn't put a group here, but sort of mathematically. Why did it work? Basically, removing one nail means setting, or means dropping that variable, either dropping X or dropping Y. So if you drop X here, you're left with YY inverse, which we saw before is a stupid way to hang a picture. And if you drop Y, you're left with X inverse, with XX inverse, which again is a stupid way to hang a picture. So which, no matter which nail you remove, the picture drops. Are you with me? Is this okay? Good. So what about three? How do you do it with three nails? So a hint had been given at the start of the talk, though it was in a different context, but sort of, how do you do it with three nails? Any suggestions? So, okay, the symbolism will be the same, right? I'll have three points, X, Y, Z, and, you know, going over X to the right will be X, going over X to the left will be X inverse, likewise for Y, likewise for Z. And I want you to describe a word in the letters X, Y, Z, X inverse, Y inverse, Z inverse, which has the property that if you drop any one of the letters, it becomes the identity. Can you think of such a word? Bob. Anybody? So basically, the word will be the commutator of a commutator with Z. So basically, this word will do. Why? So suppose I change z to be the identity, meaning I drop it, I turn it to be 1. So if I turn z to be, if I make z the identity commutes with anything. So the commutator of z with x and y will be 1. So that's the same as saying the picture drops. If I change y to be the identity, then this whole thing becomes the identity because of what we did before. So we have the identity commutator z, and that's 1. So the picture drops. And likewise, if I change x to be the identity. Now, this really means a rather lengthy way of hanging a picture. So it's x, y, x inverse, y inverse, and then, so this is just this, then z, then the inverse of this. The inverse of this means just reading this backwards, right? But inverting everything. So y inverse, x inverse. And finally, the inverse of z, so z inverse. So if you hang a picture this way, no matter which, I don't know why you would ever want to do that, right? Usually you want to do the opposite, but still. If you will hang a picture this way, no matter which nail drops, the picture will fall. So let's see what it really looks like. So it's x followed by y, followed by x inverse, followed by y inverse, followed by z, followed by y, followed by x, then y inverse, then x inverse, and then z inverse. Here you go. How come you didn't guess it? How come nobody guessed it?
Oh yeah, next step off first.
Okay, but now unfortunately I cannot implement it with my limited thing here and with, you know, just 2 fingers, but you can...
Three fingers.
I do have more than 2 fingers.
You do? Yeah. But I don't have enough strength. Anyway, but I think the mathematics is clear. It will work. Is it clear? Okay, good. So, the next problem is sort of a related problem, but I want to leave it open for you. So can you draw a link made of n components so that if you drop any one of them, the entire link, the remaining 2 fall apart? So let me give you an example. I mean, here is a link with 2 components, okay? In which if you drop any one of them, so if blue suddenly disappears from the picture, then green becomes the unknown. Okay? Likewise, had I dropped green, it would become the unknown. Had I dropped green, blue would become the unknown. Now, can I add a third component so that if I drop any one of them, the remaining thing is unknotted? So here, let me add the third component. If I drop any one of them, if I drop green, what I have is unknotted. But if I drop blue, the remaining 2 are still knotted. So that doesn't satisfy my condition. Right? Maybe I could try something else. Instead of passing it through 1, I could try to pass it through both. Will this work? No, that's even worse. If I drop blue, basically, any one I drop, the other 2 remain knotted. So is there any way to do it? Well, this is the problem for 3. What I really want you is to solve the problem for n. Can you make an n-component link so that dropping any one of them, the whole thing drops? The whole thing breaks apart. Okay, so how do you do it for 3? Well, I could tell you, well, in fact, here is a little program that draws the solution. Here it is. Okay? So this is the so-called Borromean link, and it's rather famous. And it's the reason it's famous is precisely for this property. If you drop any component, the remaining 2 are unlinked. Right? If I drop red, you can slide blue out of green. If I drop blue, green, if I drop blue, well, basically anyone I drop, the others to remain unlimited. So this is the challenge I leave you for after the talk. Can you do it with four? Can you do it with five? And there are several solutions. One of the solutions involves commutators. So, but I'm not going to tell you how to do it. You'll have to figure it out yourself. Is this okay? Good. Now we come to the main point of this talk, which appears completely unrelated. So I'm sure you've all heard of it, right? So everybody knows that you know, there is a way to solve equations of degree 2, there is a way to solve equations of degree 3, there is a way to solve equations of degree 4, but one can prove that there is no solution, no algebraic way to solve equations of degree 5. They have solutions, you can compute them numerically, but you cannot write a formula for the solution using only the basic arithmetic operations and taking roots. And in fact, part of the reason this is very, very famous is because Abel and Galois did it in the early 1800s, the first time, and Galois got really, really famous because somehow he did it when he was 20 or 19 or something, and following that he died in a duel, and his notebooks were only found like 20 years later. And another reason it's famous is because it's typically the last thing undergrads learn in algebra, math majors, math specialists, sort of the undergraduate education. It's very hard. Okay, it's a theorem that takes a whole semester, and at the end, how many of you took it? Good. So, do you really feel that you understand it?
I don't know if I remember.
somehow it takes a whole semester in which people build algebraic numbers, field extensions, prove that the sum of two algebraic numbers is again algebraic, the product of two algebraic numbers is again algebraic. Once you have a field extension, they talk about automorphisms, and it gets so complicated that at the end you don't really understand why the theorem is true. You sort of have a proof of it, but it's too long to see the picture. So my real goal today is to show you why it's true. Okay? I'm going to follow a proof by Arnold from the 1960s, but I could not find an original write-up. I don't know if it ever existed. He may have never written it. You can find write-up by Alexeyev, by Hovansky, and there is a YouTube video where I learned it. By a former student of mine. At some point sent me an email. I made a video, here it is. And that's how I learned the proof. Okay. Are you okay? Is this fine? Do you know the theory? Have you heard of this before? Okay, good. You see, if that was a 90 minutes talk, I would tell you how the Princess Bride gets related and show you a video, but it isn't. Let me start from the quadratic equation. Okay? Here's how you solve the quadratic equation. So you have a quadratic equation. Ax squared plus bx plus c is equal to 0. How do you find r? A root of that equation, you set delta, it's called the discriminant, but who cares, to be b squared minus 4ac. Then you set lowercase delta to be the square root of uppercase delta. Then you set r to be minus b plus delta over 2a. And that's the root. Now, in fact, this whole presentation is running through Mathematica. So I can compute in real time what the result of doing this thing is. So you put delta into, basically you compute, let me compute r. R is minus b plus lowercase delta, delta is that, with uppercase delta is that. So when I tell the computer to actually evaluate the last thing, here's what it tells me the answer is. I'm sure you've all seen it. You have, right? Okay, good. But let's see how it works in real life. So again, I wrote a little thing that, here are the coefficients A, B, and C, and I can move them, and as I move them, uppercase delta moves, right? Uppercase delta, can you all see? Mm-hmm. Maybe I can make it a bit bigger. Right, so when I move them, then uppercase delta moves in the complex plane, and then lowercase delta moves in the complex plane, and then as a result, R moves in the complex plane, and R is pointing at a root. Okay? So, for example, so I think if you spin C around B, then uppercase delta tends to spin around zero. Do you see that? Now, the square root function, if you remember, halves the argument of a complex number. So the square root function will spin at half the speed. So can you see that? So uppercase delta spins around, and lowercase delta spins around at half the speed. Do you see that? Mm-hmm. Good. So we've just sort of seen a little bit of this. Now let's verify that it actually works. So here's another thing I can do. So here, I'm starting from the roots. If you give me two roots, lambda 1 and lambda 2, it's very easy to produce an equation whose roots are z's. Namely, you multiply x minus lambda 1 with x minus lambda 2, you expand the result. Right? The result is in fact x squared minus lambda 1 plus lambda 2 times x plus lambda 1 times lambda 2. So a is equal to 1, b is equal to lambda 1 minus lambda 1 minus lambda 2, and c is equal to lambda 1 times lambda 2. Okay? So basically, from the roots, I can find the equation very, very easily, simply by computing some polynomials in lambda 1 and lambda 2. And then I can feed z's into the machine of the previous screen, right? So I can compute uppercase delta and then lowercase delta. By the way, here uppercase delta now is minus 1, so uppercase delta is lowercase delta is I right now. Okay? And then I can compute r, and r will point at one of the roots. In fact, r right now is pointing at lambda 1. So let's see if this continues to happen. So let's move the roots around. So if I move lambda 2, A, B, and C move around. In fact, A doesn't move because A is constant. It's just 1. But B and C move around. You see that, right? Mm-hmm. And then uppercase delta moves, lowercase delta moves, but R doesn't move because I've been moving the wrong root. But if I move lambda 1, R will move, will move in just the same way. So that verifies that the formula from before solves the equation. Are you with me? Okay, good. Now, let's do the same with the cubic equation. Oh, maybe before doing it, you may have noticed, you know, every complex number has two square roots. And the question is, which one to choose? And I actually had to modify the built-in root function in Mathematica in order to choose the right one. So let me explain. Here's a complex number. Here is its square root. It's 1, right? This complex number is 1. The square root is 1. And here is my modified square root function. But let's first look at the original, the basic square root function. The basic square root function, you have to choose each time which square root to pick. And the two square roots are, x and minus x. And you always have to choose which one. Now, there are usually conventions. So if you're looking at x and minus x, only one of them will have a positive real part, right? So, you can decide that by convention, you'll choose the one that has a positive real part. Okay? So you may decide that you will always choose a route which is on the half, right half side of the screen here. And in fact, this is the convention that Mathematica uses. So the built-in square root function, you know, if I move the parameter, it will always give an answer in the right hand, in the right half of the screen. Okay. So in fact, if I try to cross this line, the value will jump, because you see, if I move the input towards the negative numbers, then the square root moves towards the imaginary axis, and then when I cross to the other side, it wants to cross the imaginary axis, right? But then it would be in the forbidden zone, so the built-in function automatically jumps it to the negative, which is again in the allowed zone. So if I move it, it will jump. Do you see that? Now, I don't want these jumps. I want things to be nice and continuous as they were here, because I want to, my solution to keep following the input no matter what I do. So I reprogram the square root function to be the persistent square root function. What is the persistent square root function? So it's not really a function, okay? What it is the following. So every time you ask the computer what's the square root of a number, the computer looks back in its memory and find the previous time that the square root of a number was that you've asked the question, okay? And then it will give you an answer which is near the answer you got last time, okay? So, you ask the computer what's the square root of 7, the square root of 9, the answer might have been either 3 or minus 3. Then you ask the computer what's the square root of 9.1, then the computer will look at its memory, will say, oh, last time you asked what's the square root of 9, I said minus 3. So now you're asking what's the square root of 9.1, I will look at the two possibilities and choose the one which is closer to minus 3. As a result of that, when I move the parameter, the output moves continuously, right? Because when I move the input, the output, well, you know, I really need to recompute the square root again and again and again. Each time I give the same answer as before, or near what I gave before, and therefore the output moves continuously as it happens on the persistent square root function on the right. So I always use persistent square roots to get this continuity. Are you with me? Is this okay? Okay. This said, should I play this? How much time do I have?
People will have to leave in like 12 minutes.
Yeah, so maybe I don't have time. But you know, there is a famous scene from a British TV series, in which Sir Humphrey and Bernard Woolley have a certain conversation, and Sir Humphrey, who is the clever guy, is proving to Bernard Woolley, the stupid politician, how opinions can be twisted by asking repeated questions, so that each question is sort of very near the previous one, so you kind of tend to give the same answer. But if you make these repeated questions, basically by choosing these repeated questions cleverly, you could make the answer be the opposite. Or if you choose different paths of questions, the answers can be made the opposite, depending on which path you choose. So this is essentially the same as the picture that appears here. But I guess I don't have time to show that. I'm sorry. Anyway, I promised to tell you something about the quintic. And I only told you about the quadratic. So it's time to talk about the cubic. How do you solve the cubic? Well, you solve the cubic in the following way, which I'm sure you all know. So if you have C x squared plus C x plus D is equal to 0, you set uppercase delta to be minus 18 A B C D plus 4 blah blah blah, and then lowercase delta to be the square root of that, gamma to be this combination which involved A B C D and lowercase delta which we've already computed. Then uppercase, lowercase gamma is the cubic root of uppercase gamma, and then R is a certain combination of all of the things that appeared before. And if you want to know what comes out, so let me evaluate the last thing. Here's what comes out. I'm sure you all remember this formula. Good. Let's see how it works. So here are the inputs. Here is delta, here is lowercase delta, here is gamma, here is lowercase gamma, here is the result. So, again, when I move the inputs, the output moves. Well, that's not terribly surprising, but let's check that it moves in the right way. So, here I do the same as what I did for the quadratic. Okay? So, the inputs are lambda 1, lambda 2, and lambda 3. The three roots of a cubic. Out of the roots, I can construct the coefficients. I can construct the cubic. Simply, I multiply x minus lambda 1 times x minus lambda 2 times x minus lambda 3 and expand, and I get A, B, C, and D. Here they are. Then I feed it into the machine of before. So I compute delta, lowercase delta, gamma, lowercase gamma, and R. Okay? And in this case, uppercase gamma came out way outside, it came out a big number. These squares are always of unit size. So it came out here, so the square got shrunk and put on the side, okay? But in principle now, if I move the roots, if I move the lambdas, R will move in the corresponding way. Now R is pointing right now at one of the roots, at the root lambda 2. So if I'm moving the other roots, R doesn't move. The result of the formula doesn't move. But if I'm moving lambda 2, the output from the formula moves in the traces my motion. So that verifies that the machine from the previous slide solves the cubic equation. Unless my programming was cheating, and it is not. Okay? Now, here is this sort of a statement. So you have to know a little bit about complex or polynomials. Basically, in the world of polynomials or analytic functions, if an equality holds on an interval, it will hold on a part of a path. So if you have a path and an equality is known to hold on a part of it, then it will continue holding for the rest of it. That's a property of polynomials. Basically, if a polynomial vanishes on an interval, it is the zero polynomial. And as a result of it, basically, if R is pointing at lambda 2 on a part of the picture, so if you found a formula for a solution of the cubic that works in some range of parameters, open range, non-empty range, then it will continue working forever. So basically, no matter what I do, no matter how I move lambda 2, R will always continue tracing it. Okay? Good. Then there is, of course, the quartic solution. And I will not read it out to you. You can read it yourself. I will evaluate it for you just so that you'll realize that you don't want to ever see it again. And I can, you know, again, if I move the parameters, the output moves, and then I can verify that the same property holds. So what is R pointing at right now? Where is R? Oops, I don't know. Oh, here. Sorry, something went wrong. But R is still pointing at lambda 2, so if I move lambda 2, R is tracing it. Claim, no such machine exists for the quintet. And that's the celebrated Galois theorem. You cannot make a machine of that kind for the quintic. Here is the key point to the proof. The key point is the following. The persistent root of a closed path is not necessarily a closed path. Let me explain. So if I make a so here is a 10th persistent root. if the persistent route goes along a closed path, so it starts at the point, say this point, and I will let it spin around zero once, okay? And so it will come back to itself, so that will be a closed path. The route itself will not have, the route will not make a closed path. Basically, the route will go 1/10 of a cycle counterclockwise or clockwise, I don't know which one it is. Okay? That's a property of routes, and I think you, that was in the prerequisite, so I hope you all know it. Okay? That's not interesting. The interesting thing is the following thing. If a closed path is the commutator of two closed paths, and you already know what the commutator of two closed paths is. It just means, you know, do A, then do B, then do A backwards, and do B backwards. Then its persistent root is a closed path. Why? Because by how much does the root of a closed path fail to be closed? It fails by the number of times that you spun around zero. If you spun around zero, you know, three times, you'd be moving three units counterclockwise over here. Okay? So, but three is a natural number, an integer, and the integer numbers are commutative. So basically, if path A spun around three times, then the persistent root of path A will not be closed. If path B spun around twice, then the root of path B will not be closed. But how many times will A inverse B inverse spin around zero? So it will go three times with A, then twice with B, then three backwards with A, then twice two backwards with B, so overall it will spin around zero, zero times. So its root will be closed. So that's the only property you need to know. Are you with me? I'm sort of out of time, so you better be with me. Okay? Anyway, here's the proof. Now the end of the proof. There is the conclusion of the proof. So suppose now there actually was a machine that solves the quintic. So there was a machine solving, you know, so basically I have lambda 1, lambda 2, lambda 3, lambda 4, lambda 5, the roots of a quintic, and then I apply the map C that computes the coefficients of that quintic. So the coefficients will be A, B, C, D, E, F, whatever. Actually, A will always be 1, so I should have written A here. It doesn't really matter. Okay? Then the machine consists of iterations of computing polynomials of in A, B, C, D, E. So computing polynomials of the things seen before. So that's the first step. And then computing a root of something that appeared here. And then maybe more polynomials and more roots. And let's say at the end you compute a root. So step 4 of the machine would be to compute a root. And then it points at R. And R is pointing at lambda 2. Okay? So I claim no such machine could exist. And of course, you know, I stopped after step 4, but I really meant, you know, any number of steps. So why? Okay, so suppose you had paths gamma 1 through gamma 16 in x0, in the space of given roots. Okay? So, suppose you had paths gamma 1 through gamma 16, and I'll call them generation 1 paths. Then I can define new paths by taking their commutators. So, the commutator of 1 and 2, I will call it generation 2 gamma 1. The commutator of 3 and 4, it will be generation 2 gamma 2. The commutator of so on up to commutator of 15 and 16, it will be generation 2 path 8. Now I have 8 paths of generation 2. I can use them in pairs to make 4 paths of generation 3. Then now I have 4 paths in generation 4. I can make generation 4 paths. And finally, generation 5 path will be sort of the result of the entire tournament. So it's the commutator of all commutators of all commutators of commutators of the paths originally chosen. Okay? I claim that if you feed gamma 5, gamma generate, the final thing, into this big machine, so you feed gamma 5 into C and then P1, R1, and so on, you'll get a closed path. Why? So let's feed gamma 5, or let's feed all of these paths into this machine. What do we get? So in X0, so back here, none of the paths were necessarily closed, because I failed to start to tell you at the start, the paths I want are paths that permute the roots. Okay? So all I want is to use paths like of the following general shape. So like a path that will bring lambda 1 to lambda 2, lambda 3 to lambda 1, and lambda 2 to lambda 3. Okay? So, you know, a path of the form, well, lambda 2 moves aside to make room, lambda 1 moves to where lambda 2 was, lambda 3 moves to where lambda 1 was, and lambda 2 moves to where lambda 3 was. So these are the paths I want. So paths that spin the root around, but bring the set of roots to where it was. So basically only permuting the roots. So the set of all roots stays where it was, but their identity switches. Okay? So such paths are not closed in X0. Well, you don't come back to where you started. However, once you apply C, so once you look at their images here, they are closed paths. Because, well, you know, if you basically, because these were obtained by expanding the product of X minus lambda I, and product is commutative. So, you know, if the set of paths returns to where it was, the set of coefficients, then each individual coefficient returns to where it was. So over here, all of the paths are closed. Now you apply a set of polynomials to the paths. So you apply a well-defined univalent, univalued, single-valued function to a path, right? You know, you have two spaces, a map between them, and you have a path here, and you apply the function to it, it's still a closed path. So all of the paths are still closed here. Now you apply the root function. The root function is weird because it has this funny property that closed paths don't necessarily go to closed paths. So after R1, the first generation paths are not necessarily closed. But the second generation paths are commutator of first generator generation paths, so they are closed. So after R1, the gamma 1s may open up, but the gamma 2s remain closed. Well, now you apply another bunch of polynomials, the gamma 2s remain, generation 2 remain closed, but now you apply root, another root level, and the gamma 2s may open up, but the gamma 3s will remain closed. And if you follow this, the last generation will remain closed. I mean, if I chosen enough generation, if I picked my passes to have more generations than there are steps in the machine, then the last path remains closed. But wait, that's impossible. Because I could have chosen my permutations induced. The permutations that the first 16 paths induce, I could have chosen them to be the permutations on page 1, on slide 1. So those permutations whose commutators of commutators of commutators of commutators are the cycle 1, 2, 3. Okay? Had I chosen gamma 1 through gamma 16 so that they would induce the permutations shown in example 4 on your handout, then gamma 5 would induce the cyclic permutation of lambda 1, lambda 2, lambda 3. But that would mean that r would have to continuously point at lambda 2, but lambda 2 moves to a different place. So r, so the machine at the end applied to gamma 5 will produce a non-closed path. QED. Okay.
Oh wow.
So I know this is interesting, but well, anyway, it's much less intricate than the standard Galois theory proof. In fact, you know, if you stare at it for another 15 minutes, and all you need to do is to stare at the picture, at the, you know, the proof shown here, you will forever remember why the quintic has no solutions, cannot be solved. Now, advantages and disadvantages, so this is way easier than the usual proof, but it also has advantages. I hardly use any properties of anything. In fact, I didn't really use properties of polynomials. I could have used any univalent function. So you cannot solve the quintic using x or sine or the Riemann zeta function and roots, and not even log. I mean, log is multivalued, but if you can still include it here, there, in it. So it's a much stronger theorem because it's somehow topologically hardly uses anything. On the other hand, the classical Galois theory tells you that some specific equations cannot be solved in terms of rational numbers and roots thereof, and iterated roots thereof. This I'm not claiming. This I cannot do. I can only tell you that there is no general formula. It is conceivable that each individual equation will have a different sort of way of writing its solution. This I cannot, this I don't know how to do. And I think I have to skip this one as well, and that's it.
Thank you so much. Now, some folks can stay and we can have some conversations and questions for Dr. Barnaton. Others should run to class and say that John Mackey authorizes your latitude or whatever it is. I don't know. I'm thinking geometrically. Now, in fact, for this man, I'm thinking geometrically.
Are you thinking geographically?
I don't know. Don't make a closed loop, okay?